Welcome to Forward Thinking, a podcast from Foundation Source. I'm your host, Dori Krieger. Foundation Source is the nation's largest provider of comprehensive support services for private foundations, bringing unparalleled knowledge and expertise to over 1,200 clients across the country. The best ideas in philanthropy aren't always the tried and true. Trailblazing entrepreneurs and next-generation philanthropists are transforming the sector with inspiring ideas and innovative strategies. Join us as we explore the advice, experience, and insight of some of the creative minds shaping our collective future. In this segment of Forward Thinking, we explore the weight a parent's legacy, an extremely successful, famous, and high-achieving parent, can have on the next generation. You'll find this description on Amazon.com. Anxiety, fear of failure, self-consciousness. These are not the qualities you imagine when you hear the word heiress. In her book, Lonely at the Top, Christina Lewis Halpern applies a journalist's eye to her own struggles following the death of her father, the late entrepreneur Reginald F. Lewis. At the time of his death in 1993, Halpern's father was the richest black man in America, the Jackie Robinson of American business. His best-selling biography, Why Should White Guys Have All the Fun?, details his amazing rags-to-riches journey from the poverty of segregated Baltimore to the boardrooms of Wall Street. Christina is a self-described idealist. She is a writer, social entrepreneur, philanthropist, investor, and founder of All Star Code, a not-for-profit education organization dedicated to closing the systematic opportunity gap between young men of color and the tech sector. Christina, thank you for being in the studio with me this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Dori. It is an honor to be able to meet here and speak with you.
There's a line in your book, "A legacy can be a load." And then you go on to talk about how it might have been more baggage than you were willing to carry. Tell us a little bit about that load and what it represented to you.
Yes, so "A legacy can be a load" is something I wrote that is a little counterintuitive to how the general public might perceive someone in my position. So I'm a native New Yorker. I grew up here in the city, but my parents came from Baltimore when it was segregated, and my mother grew up in a tiny fishing village. They were incredibly successful strivers. They met here in the 60s through happenstance, but like so many New Yorkers, came, planted their roots, and then ended up with amazing success professionally, economically. My father generated tremendous wealth and really are part of the fabric of this city. And, my mother is a noted philanthropist. I am very lucky to be part of such a legacy. At the same time, it's a lot to live up to. I recognized that I had to think through and really confront that I've had long felt this burden of expectation. And that is something that was really aggravated by the death of my father when I was 12. And at the time, we were living in Paris. My father owned an international conglomerate called TLC Beatrice. And then after he passed, his legacy became something then that I inherited, at a really young age. And so while I feel, that journey and that struggle over who I am and how to cope with the expectations of my family and of the world as a quote unquote heiress, they were really magnified for me because I inherited that legacy along with my sister, Leslie, who is a noted producer and actor. I inherited that legacy at 12 when I really wasn't ready for it. So when I say that a legacy can be a load, I really felt that and had felt that at the time that I wrote this book 4 or 5 years ago. It was something I was just coming to grips with.
When you were researching your book, is there something particular about your father that you discovered that surprised you?
Yes. Yes, there is. When you knew someone only when you were 12 and
right.
A child, particularly your father, I had a really outsized impression and memory of him. Mm-hmm. He's like a god almost.
Right.
Your father, you really idealize him and idolize him, and he remains such an inspiration to me. And again, his story is one of being born in a very poor area of Baltimore, when it was segregated, when African Americans couldn't vote. And through the dint of his own efforts with an incredible discipline, work ethic, charm, ended up ramming his way through this racist society, this racist hierarchy, and ending his life at the top of American society, of business, of wealth, and owning this billion-dollar company, being the CEO of the largest Black-owned firm in the country. And that is something I realized was true, yet is not the whole story. Mm-hmm. And I learned as I really went in and researched his life that he had had a lot of help along the way. And of course, a lot of help along the way from, of course, family, and not just his parents and his mother, who's just a wonderful pillar of the community and is still alive in Baltimore, but from teachers and friends and others. And in particular, I focused on his time at Harvard Law School. One of the craziest and most impressive stories about my father is how he got into Harvard Law School without even applying. And indeed, he had been part of the first class of a very unique access program that several Harvard Law School professors put together to realize that they needed to actually start recruiting from the Black colleges, which is where my father was studying. For the first time ever, they actually recruited from schools where, through segregation, all of the Black students, or virtually all the Black students, were attending. My father was part of that first class. And he was someone who had always wanted to be a lawyer, yet wouldn't have had the opportunity to enter corporate law if he hadn't gone and graduated from Harvard Law School. And he was recruited to the program, which was not a ticket into Harvard, yet he so impressed the professors that they let him in, even though they really shouldn't have.
It's a great story about getting into Harvard.
Yes.
Talk about trailblazing and making your way for yourself.
Yes.
And it's without even a formal application, if I remember correctly.
Yes, that's right. My father got into Harvard Law School without formally applying, and he did not even take the LSAT. That is,
I'd like to see someone try that today.
I know. Well, it would be very difficult, and I might say even impossible to do today. And I spoke directly with the head of admissions about that. It's a different time, but certainly there are ways to kick down doors for yourself.
What I wanted to get through that question, though, was this realization that, you have this godlike feeling for your father, and you're like, whoa, look at these grades. That was kind of an interesting moment in the
book.
Yes,
right. Yeah.
So I'd love to hear, you talk about living up to these expectations. You're like, huh, how do I feel about these grades?
What surprised me is that it's kind of a good thing that he didn't take the LSAT, because from everything I saw, his actual score would not have been very good by those conventional means.
Mm-hmm.
I know that has nothing to do with the actual intelligence and capability, and everything to do with his, with his education, with his exposure, his preparation for that very specific kind of test,
mm-hmm.
and his education, and further that, throughout his life, he had had to work. From age 9, he had been working to make money for himself and doing that very successfully. But whereas many students are able to just focus on their studies, he was not. And he grew up in a neighborhood where there weren't the same kind of opportunities that would have enabled him to do something that is, like pass a very technical test. Yet this, at the time, really struck me, because I had always thought of my father as the best at everything. And from that, I realized that, this was something actually that he was bad at. Yet he was still able to be so successful. And that was something that now, as I realize now, seems obvious to me, that you do not need to be good at everything
mm-hmm.
in order to be successful and to be a pioneer. And the secret to life is focusing on your strengths and, forgetting about your weaknesses, or at least never letting them stop you from what you feel you deserve. Yet that was a real surprise to me. And I was able to get his transcript also and saw that many of his grades were poor. Mm-hmm. And that his first year at Harvard Law School, and if you've seen The Paper Chase, you know that they tell you, you know, here's the first day, look to the left of you, look to the right of you, right. One of you will not be here at the end of the year. And it was this trial by fire experience. And my father was extremely worried about whether he could hack it. But all students were, you know, all of the first year students were. It was incredibly stressful. Yet my father was borderline, frankly. He was borderline. And that was really a shock to me.
It sounds like it was also, though, a powerful discovery for you to kind of see a fuller picture of your father. How did that really impact you?
So when I realized that my father was not actually good at everything, it was tremendously freeing for me because I had been holding myself to this standard that I had to be good at everything. And if I failed in one little thing, it was this crisis of identity, and it left me, frankly, really high strung and too much of a perfectionist. So it was freeing to realize that he had done poorly at something as well. But I learned that instead of having him fall apart, ruin his confidence, he just kind of moved on from it. And I saw that was actually the secret to success. It's failing and being fine with it, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. learning from it and moving on. So that was a big reason that I founded All Star Code. It empowered me to think around just my strengths instead of my weaknesses. I have always had really strong ideas, and I've always felt this desire to help historically oppressed peoples, particularly the Black community, but Latinos, and we do a lot of work in the Philippines, and you know, we've supported different causes in the gay community as well. And I think deeply around how we can create a more equal place for them, and focused especially on socioeconomic mobility in the workforce. And so I realized that those were my strengths, and I should forget about all the things that I was bad at and stop trying to improve there, and instead focus on what I was good at and how I could put something together from that.
It's interesting, your work with All Star Code, too, because it is kind of tapping into your own passions. And at the same time, I think kind of honoring this legacy of your father's story. So it's kind of this beautiful progression of that. And so tell us a little bit more about All Star Code. What exactly is the work that you're doing?
The mission of All Star Code is to ensure that young men of color, Black and Latino boys, can succeed at the highest level of the tech industry. I do not know if you know, but the tech industry, which is the engine of job growth and wealth creation in this country, is extremely undiverse. Only 10% of Google, which is the largest technology companies, is non-white or non-East Asian. So that includes Blacks, Latinos, people who are other, American, Native Americans. And of course, the percentage of the population is 40%. So overall, racial and ethnic minorities are extremely poorly represented in the entire tech workforce. Yet that percentage includes janitorial staff or people anywhere in the company. And if you were to focus on engineering, which is the driving force of a technology company like Google, the percentages are much, much lower. They're minuscule. So this is a huge problem from a national standpoint. We need to include more people in the job creation and innovation engine that is the tech industry, or we'll never find diverse ideas to solve, you know, so many of our problems. If we're not participating in the sector that is creating all the jobs, jobs that are a ticket into the middle class, how will we ever solve the wealth inequality problem? So how do we ensure that young men of color can succeed in tech? We teach them coding. Coding is a superpower today, not just because it teaches you how to build things on the computer, web apps and mobile apps, which is what our students learn to do, but also because it gets you to think like a hacker. You know, and a hacker is someone who can create things on their own, but who also understands how to collaborate in teams with other people. And a hacker has learned to celebrate failure, which is something that it took me a long time to learn to do, as we just spoke. But in order to learn to code, you have to fail all the time. That is, in fact, how you learn, because the program will give you an error. Like, you try it, you write it, and it will error on you. And it will not work, and it will not work. And I've been told by one of the best coding teachers in the country that you have to be willing to sit there for 8 hours and just
and
get
fail.
It wrong and fail.
For 8 hours
constantly. Constantly. That is how you learn. So that's a very necessary skill to learn in coding. And by teaching that to our youth, and over 50% of our youth are low income, and they are 80% Black and Latino, we have realized that we can also teach them to start celebrating failure and to start feeling good about learning and to be open to working in teams and to sharing information. And it's those skills, those life and relational skills, that mindset, that will ultimately, we feel, drastically increase their economic potential and the kind of jobs that they receive.
You've described your father as an active and visionary philanthropist, and you use the example of his historic gift to Harvard Law. And I certainly don't want to leave out your mother, who you've mm-hmm. described as an active philanthropist as well. Mm-hmm. How has that influenced who you are as a philanthropist and then also as the founder of All Star Code?
Thank you for asking that. How my father's pioneering gift to Harvard Law School, which was the largest gift the school had ever received from an individual. And that's not just a Black person, that is any individual. He was the most generous alumni that Harvard Law School had at that point in the 1990s. I realized from that I am really a philanthropreneur. And my father was as well. Now, a philanthropreneur is someone who is able to give, but then uses their funds in a way that is impactful. It's not a hands-off relationship where you just give it away and people can do what they want with it. You attach to it and put with it a certain idea. There is a change that you want to see happen in the world, and you target and direct your funds towards that. At the same time, if you are someone who has a lot of money, and that means that you also have other things. You have network, you have connections, you have access to powerful people who all can be harnessed to make this change happen. And money is, of course, the driver to that. You can't, you know, an all-volunteer organization only goes so far. You need staff to, you know, to do it, to spread right. the message about it. It doesn't happen all on its own. You need people
driving
it
forward.
You're building a movement. And so a philanthropreneur, as I am, is one who sees an idea, puts money behind it because they believe in it, but also is willing to invest their time, their energy, the sweat equity to make it happen. And when I first had the idea for All Star Code, I was able to immediately attract some funds to it in terms of seed funding. And I was lucky that I was able to do that to get us started. And that I also took the ownership to make sure that it happens. And now I am both the founder and the executive director of the organization. By the way, we've now reached, in just 18 months of operation, we've reached over 500 students through our hackathons and workshops that we sponsor throughout the year using our unique curriculum. And we'll have graduated 60 students from our flagship summer intensive program by the end of this year.
Impressive. I want to go back to thinking more about parents and grandparents' legacy. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about what advice do you have for parents or grandparents who might be the wealth creators themselves in thinking about raising their children and influencing their grandchildren?
Absolutely. I think, you know, parents and grandparents who are wealth creators have an enormous influence over their kids and grandkids, so much that they may not even fully realize how much their children and grandchildren really idolize them. And in addition to, of course, loving their children and accepting them, and the goal is to help them build confidence. And some wealth creators, I feel, take a really harsh view on their kids and say things like, I don't want you to inherit too much of my money. You know, I don't want you to be spoiled. I had to work so hard to do this. You'll never have to do that, but I want you to be. And essentially saying these things that they don't intend to come off this way, but can come off to kids like they're not as good as their parents and will never be. And that's a really crippling message to kids, especially if they've been hearing it sort of all their life. And I think parents should think about that more and think around, that's not the message that they want to be sending. Because I'd say that next generation, people who have inherited the legacy, actually have more opportunities to do amazing things. Mm-hmm. But when you've inherited something, that means that you have more to play with and grow. And in the realm particularly of the arts, of policy, of government, these are areas where second generation can more easily make an impact.
So when we were talking previously, you talk about how a family foundation could help children and parents talk about money and be a tool to have those conversations. Would you share a little bit more?
Yes, I believe that philanthropy is the perfect tool for cross-generational education within families. So my father actually took me to a library where he was giving a grant. And actually, it was the American Library in Paris, which is where I spent all my time. I was this huge reader. And he went and handed me a check for $10,000 and said, "You give it to the head of the library." I said, fine.
And so how old are you?
I might have been 10.
Right.
And this is more money than I've like ever actually seen and had. And I was there giving it away. And it gave me this real sense of the value of money. Because whenever I wanted to buy something, and of course at that age it was nowhere near, I mean, that was just a mind-blowing amount. But I always thought, you know, you can do this with it, but you can also give it away. And each time I make a choice around what to invest in, that, you know, that's part of my thinking. So it teaches the value of money. It's also just a great way to spend time with your children, and especially grandchildren, for the grandparents out there. And, you know, because it's fun. Mm-hmm. and it's productive.
And what would you say to your peers, your colleagues, your members of the next generation?
So you are powerful. Not because of what you inherited, because of what you do with it. So if you've inherited something, but you do nothing with it, then it's nothing. And if you inherit something and you do just a little bit with it, you just end up like kind of staying flat. Fine. But if you learn something and you learn a skill, and I worked for many years as a professional journalist at the Wall Street Journal, and I learned so much about life skills, job skills, reporting, people, and those are the skills I bring now to All Star Code along with others. So if you actually apply yourself and learn things and develop skills and find your own talents and awareness, then you can come to your legacy, your inheritance, whatever it is, and grow it exponentially.
I began with a description of your ebook on Amazon.com, which was filled of insecurity and anxiety and so kind of self-consciousness, right? I think it takes a lot of confidence to tell your story with such candor. It's just you're being so honest and forthcoming. And thank you.
Thank you. The book experience of the book did show me our common humanity, because here I am. Yeah, this very, I mean, I have a very unique background. I'm half Black and half Filipino. I grew up in New York and Paris. You know, I got a lot of money, but my dad died, and, you know, my relatives are still a varying, you know, socioeconomic circumstances. So I'm so weird. I always thought I was weird. And yet, when I write this personal book, people from across the spectrum, I mean, of
it
all
resonates.
Races, you know, not just women, but men have written to me. It resonates. It's, you know, for so many different people without money, or, you know, people who have you know, who are middle class, and others, and that's just, again, very heartwarming. So thank you for saying that.
Thank you.
To learn more about this segment of Forward Thinking and our work at Foundation Source, please visit our resources page at foundationsource.com. While you're there, tell us what you thought of this segment and who you'd like to hear in a future one. We'd love to hear from you. Our podcast is produced by Gabrielle Galanek. I'm your host, Dori Krieger.